you're immersed in Texas. I mean, you have a much larger region that you cover, but you're immersed in Texas.
That's right.
Which is growing in terms of its presence on the national stage.
The interesting thing about being reporting from Texas for the last 20 years is Texas is in the Republican vanguard. So what is happening inside the Republican Party and what is happening inside Texas is coming to a country near you. We're just out in front of it. And it's been interesting to watch. I mean, California Republicans kind of self-destructed with anti-Hispanic immigration that ended up blowing them off the map. And the Bush family watched what happened and decided that they were not going to go down that road. They were going to be friends to Hispanics. And Bush, he would go down to Brownsville, he'd walk the border, San Antonio, go to these parades, try to speak bad Spanish. I mean, he was getting 43%, 45% of the Hispanic vote when he was running for governor. I think he got close to 50% of the Hispanic vote in Texas when he ran for president. That has changed completely now. Bush's name is mud in the Republican Party in Texas, believe it or not. You know, they think he was terrible. You know, they hated that he did Medicare Part B. And they see him as a big spender now. And they see him as a sellout on immigration. And they want to follow the down the path of the California Republican Party. And they're doing it. You know, they're about to pass very harsh immigration laws, sanctuary cities legislation. I'm not sure it's all going to hold up in court, but the last big proponent of establishment Republican point of view is the Speaker of the House, Joe Strauss. He just retired. And he was the guy who was killing a lot of legislation that Texas business did not want, like the bathroom bill, like anti-LGBT legislation that they knew that if we passed that, big corporations weren't going to come to Texas. Like anti-immigration or anti-Hispanic legislation that was going to screw the home building industry, the agricultural industry, the hospitality industry, all of which depend on undocumented labor to put the roofs on those homes, to clean those rooms and those hotel rooms. And, I mean, I did this interview with Purdue Chickens, I don't know. He's a big chicken guy. And there was a proposal to this anti-Hispanic, anti-immigration proposal to stop letting children who grew up in Texas but who were undocumented, we let them have in-state tuition to go to college. And they're proposing ending that. And Purdue was dead set against it. He was like, who's going to pick up my chickens? You got to bend your back to pick up my chickens. He's talking about picking them off the floor and putting them in the crates to send them off. It's, so you bend your back to pick chickens off the floor about 1,000 times a day, and you're doing it for $12 an hour or $10 an hour. And he knows that the only people who are going to do this work are undocumented immigrants. And so we're seeing this clash right now in Texas, where the Texas Association of Business sounds like left-wing liberal Democrats now, because they're the ones opposing the Republican Party's attempts to do these, you know, very conservative, draconian measures, and their biggest stopgap just retired. So I think we're about to see the Republican Party in Texas take another really big step to the right. And I think we're going to see that mirrored in the National Republican Party soon afterwards. So, you know, it's been very interesting for me to watch this development of the party, this the way the party is headed. It's always been to the right continuously, and it has not stopped. And I just wonder, you know, how this is going to play out.
Well, I think at that very sort of edge of your seat juncture, I want to open this up to Q&A formally. So, but can I ask one last question, which is my favorite question, which is, what do you wish I would ask you?
Well, that's a good question. I haven't thought what I wanted you to ask me. Let's see. How it is that I haven't become a famous movie star yet, maybe? I don't know how I haven't become a famous movie star. It's a mystery to me, too, so thanks for asking that.
KG?
We have about 15 minutes for questions from you folks. If we have two
There's no pressure now. If you just want to call it a night, say, I've heard enough, let's go have a beer, that's okay.
If you'll raise your hand and either... Who's going to come? Oh, Patrick or Matthew will come up and bring you the microphones. Let's start over here on this side.
So I understand now how you gather information, that you don't have a notepad, you're not writing furiously, you're listening.
Yes, I try.
And you are putting a lot of that into your head. But tell me how it is it comes out of your head. Do you, and that may sound silly, but I mean, do you sit down at a typewriter and create a document, or do you dictate something? Because I think for some people, what comes out of their mouth is different than what comes out of their fingertips, even though they've heard the same thing.
So I don't do it the way the vast majority of radio reporters do it, because no one taught me. So the way most reporters do, the radio reporters do it, is they go and they pick their best tape, and then they order it, and then they write to that tape. I don't do that. I just start to write, and then I look for the tape that I need to go to where I've written to. And so the tape is secondary for me, while it's primary for the vast majority of my colleagues.
But it's all in your head. I mean, that tape is in your head.
Yes, yes. I mean, I've gone through it, but I mean, the way I do it sometimes means that I leave some of my best tape on the floor because it didn't fit with what I was writing, while most reporters are going to fit whatever they write to the best tape. The other thing is that over time I learned that it is okay to allow what I think the story has taught me to go into the piece. And you don't need to make it some sort of moral of the story, but if you take people along the journey that you've just traveled while you were reporting this piece, it's helpful if you let them in on the insights that you got at the same time while you're reporting it. So I'm not afraid to have some of that learning that I've done get in there. So there's a little bit of analysis sometimes in my piece that's simply a function of the fact that, I thought this, you know, right here. I should put that in there. And I think that's kind of, I think that maybe answers a little bit of your question, but basically I'm just trying to say to the listener everything that I think I've learned in the process of reporting the piece, including maybe some of the things that are simply ideas that came out of my head as a result. That's okay, as long as they're completely supported by all the reporting that's in the piece. I mean, you can't, you know, take a flyer and start pontificating on deeply held, long-held beliefs. You've got to have it all be connected to the work. But if it is, then you can talk about what you think about what you're reporting on here.
Another question?
My question is, the gun lobby has done a very effective job of framing the issue of gun sales and gun ownership, and the question is, how is this narrative going to change from a Second Amendment issue to something other than that? Because in my opinion, it's been an aberration of Second Amendment. So how will the narrative change? Who's going to change it? What has to happen?
I mean, I don't know the answer to that question. We've been thinking about this for a long time. And you can see that there's a certain quality of resignation to the quality of the news coverage now, because there's a feeling that it doesn't matter what we say or how we report, the drumbeat of murder is going to continue and the pace is going to pick up. And so there's a certain, I think there's a certain numb quality to the journalism. I mean, I think there's some noble attempts to break out of it. You know, and I credit the New York Times for staying on this. But it is difficult to try to say anything new. And also to keep kind of an element of resignation, political resignation, out of your copy. I mean, there's a certain element of despair, and it's hard to have that not affect how you think about these things. I mean, I think there's a widespread acknowledgement that it doesn't matter how many die or who dies or in what circumstances they die, nothing's going to change. And so that political reality, I think, is set pretty deep in stone right now. You know, I wonder, as the pace continues, will we all become completely inured? Or will it begin to affect how people see the politicians who allow this to continue? And I do not know the answer to that question, which way it goes. I truly do believe that whatever hope we have in this regard lies with the women in the country.
We have another question on the same side of the room.
Yes, hi. My question is sort of about the tape on the floor aspect that you were talking about earlier. As a listener, I think there are times when we really consider, for instance, in mass shootings, where not so much in this latest mass shooting where it seemed to be a domestic fueled incident, but where a lot of times mass shooters are looking for the glory sort of in going out.
Going out in a blaze of glory.
Right. That being one extreme end where that's obviously an event that can't not be covered, but there's a lot of debate about how to cover that and what to cover, to sort of the other extreme where I, as a listener, have said, okay, this person who's being interviewed represents less than 0.01% of the population. What they're saying is neither insightful nor intelligent and is a waste of my time. And I guess I really wonder, as a reporter, how do you make the decision? I understand the idea of giving alternate viewpoints equal coverage, so to speak, but I also think, like, do I really need to indulge this idiotic BS all the way to sort of, this is a really important event that should be covered, and yet it fulfills goals that are totally contrary to the purpose of media coverage. And I wonder how do you make the decisions of what to leave on the cutting floor, what to include, what voices, no matter how, in my opinion as a reader, stupid or radical or minority should be covered, and how you decide to include those.
Well, as a reporter in Texas, you can imagine that it occurs to my editors in Washington, D.C., when we're talking about these subjects, to say, let's send Wade Goodwin out to get gun owners' perspectives, right? He's in Texas. And so I have had a lot of experience going out. It's a difficult subject to talk about. There's a long history in the South of gun ownership that goes back to slavery, when you were trying to repress tens of thousands of people who outnumber you 100 to 1. It can make you nervous that things could possibly go badly in the future, and in order to assuage your nervousness, you might heavily arm yourself. And so it became an integral part of the culture, I think. It goes back 300 years. And even after slavery ended, we had Jim Crow. We were constantly in the South trying to send messages to a population of human beings that they needed to stay in their place and they needed to do what we said. And it really was helpful if we were heavily armed while we were trying to do that. And so it's impossible to kind of talk about these things in that sort of way, but the idea of being heavily armed is deeply woven into Southern culture. And I would say it has spread to rural culture around the country. I'd be interested to know if it's how different it is in rural Pennsylvania than it is in rural East Texas. But, you know, I've been struck by the number of Confederate flags that one might find flying in upstate New York, for example. And I think that's not because the Confederate battle flag is some symbol of the Confederacy. I think it is morphed into a subtle symbol of white supremacy. And not that the people who fly that really necessarily think that's what they're communicating, but deep down, that's part of what they are communicating. And so when you take race on the one hand and gun ownership on the other, it can be a very powerful dynamic, and it's one that's almost impossible to talk about. I mean, for me to even say the words I just said is a fairly radical notion, and not one that you're going to find a lot of reporters or anyone else, for that matter, talking about. But I really do believe that that's part of what's going on here, is this long history of having to repress hundreds of thousands of people, and it's not easy to do, and it's much easier if you're heavily armed. And that's, you know, I think that's why we have loved our guns in the South. But don't tell anybody I said that, okay?
We have time for two more questions. Yes, sir.
Okay, along similar lines, when people talk about their ability to have a gun, they say it's in the Second Amendment to the Constitution. I suspect they've never read the Second Amendment to the Constitution. They don't really understand why those folks who founded this country put it there. You've just pointed out that most of the folks who carry guns, be it in the South, or in Western Pennsylvania, that we have a lot of redneck areas in this part of the world too, use the Second Amendment as an excuse to avoid saying exactly what you just got done saying. And isn't it your duty, and maybe my duty too, to point that out? That you just can't simply point to the Second Amendment and say, well, that gives me the right to do anything I want to do with a gun that can shoot 1,000 rounds of ammunition in 30 seconds and that kind of stuff. The Founding Fathers never meant that to be. Yet that's the excuse that is used over and over again by the NRA. And the other day I was listening to this idiot Republican, I'm sorry, you know where I'm coming from, congressman, when asked, well, shouldn't we begin to ban these kinds of things? And he said, well, should we begin to ban trucks because trucks ran down and killed a bunch of people in New York? That's totally idiotic. You know, there is no comparison.
Well, I do think that any notion that you're going to convince people of that your understanding of what the Second Amendment means is, trumps their understanding of what the Second Amendment means is hopeless. And I could spend the rest of my life, and all my breath, and it will convince nobody. I do think that there's a lot of wishful thinking on the part of some liberals that if we just said the right words or held people's feet to the fire, that somehow that would show them, and then I don't know what would happen after that. They'd change their mind, or I don't know. But it's not going to happen. It doesn't happen. Their understanding of the Second Amendment and what it means to them, they hold very dear and precious, and they have a whole worldview that's built around gun ownership. There's practically nothing more important to them in the world than this right. So, if they had their way, it'd be the First Amendment, not the Second, freedom of speech, that could be like the 29th Amendment or something. And so I just don't know that pointing, words like, you know, a well-organized militia, hello, is really going to be the key to changing their ideas about these things. In fact, I know it's not. I mean, you got to start with where people are at and listen to them and try to understand them. And as far as convincing them that where they're at is wrong, I mean, I wish you the best, but it's not going to be something that I'm going to be trying to do because I've learned it's a waste of my time.
One more very brief question, please.
So I guess briefly, in my work, I deal with science and evidence-based and hypothesis-driven stuff. As a storyteller, do you think there's too much narrative in the news today?
I would say no. I think that narrative is how people learn. It's how you keep people with you. I mean, narrative is like we start at A, then we go to B, and then that led us to C, and then we're at D, and you can kind of see how we got there. I don't think narrative is the enemy of science. I think it's the ally of science. You use narrative to weave the data you have in your story into something that's compelling and understandable, and that leaves people thinking, wow, that was good. I'm going to remember that. And without science, without data, your narrative is pretty thin. It's pretty shallow. I just don't know. I mean, I don't know that I ever, that's a very interesting question. I don't really know that I've ever thought that narrative is somehow the enemy of science or data. You know, it's not in my experience. Not in how I think about it, but that's something I probably should think about more.
Ladies and gentlemen, NPR's Wade Goodwin and WESA.
Thanks, guys. It was a pleasure. Five. Thanks for coming out.
Thank you.
And now a few final words from our president and CEO, Terry O'Reilly.
Did I tell you they were going to be good or what? Thank you very much for joining us. This is just such a terrific treat, and I've had a chance to spend a little bit of time with Wade over the last day or so when he was in Pittsburgh, and I'm sort of keeping up my skills as a driver, because if this broadcasting thing doesn't work out, I want to fall back on something. I want to thank Dee and John Hoyt again for making tonight possible, and their generosity to us really was sort of from the inspiration to bring Wade in to providing us with a bit of support for this evening. So if you would join me in thanking them. And I'd like to leave you with a quote. And I know it's hokey to end with a quote, but this was something that I thought was really very good. It comes from a professor at Yale, a guy by the name of Timothy Snyder. And in a book that he released, it's a very small book, so. He released it this spring, and he said, to abandon facts is to abandon freedom. If nothing is true, then no one can criticize power, because there is no basis upon which to criticize it. If nothing is true, then all is spectacle, and the biggest wallet pays for the most blinding light. You know, your support of the work that we do and the work that Wade does and the terrific work that Margaret does, you know, assures that the only entity to whom we are beholden is you. And we remain committed to standing with the facts, which is something you hear us say all the time. So I am told that there is still a bit of mingling time left, and I am told that there is still an open bar. So I would invite you to stay for a little while. We're all going to be around, and we'd love to chat with you. Thanks again for coming tonight.